And now, with Sound Investing, here's Paul Merriman.
One of my personal challenges is taking on more projects than I have time for, but I did, when I started the year, have one in mind and was about to start on the project. And it was a series, or it is a series, of podcasts, as well as some links to information about people that I consider to be the top truth tellers. And of course, these are truth tellers from the financial community. And the one that was right on the top of the list would be, of course, John, or as a lot of people call him, Jack Bogle. And as we all know, Jack Bogle had recently passed away at age 89. And so it was the perfect time for me to share my comments about the number one truth teller. And I'm sorry that it took the occasion of his passing to do this, but I will tell you that in the process of thinking about the impact he's had on the industry, on investors, and on the work that we are doing at our foundation, Jack Bogle has been a huge source of motivation for me and for hundreds of thousands of other people. So I'm going to approach it like this. I want to talk about what others have said about him, a lot from Jason Zweig. Actually, Jason Zweig is also on my list of the top 10 truth tellers. And Jason Zweig is a columnist for the Wall Street Journal and has written several books that I think are very good. One that I recommend to everybody is entitled Your Money and Your Brain. But Jason has written a couple of articles recently, and specifically with Jack's passing. He has probably spent more time as a journalist interviewing Bogle of anybody that I know, because he started way back in 1993. And he has a couple of articles. The latest one is, it's in the Wall Street Journal, What Drove Jack to Upend Investing? What Drove Jack to Upend Investing? And in this piece, he gives some history that I think you'll find of interest. In fact, that there was some very interesting new information to me, because I have focused most of my thoughts about Jack's work and Vanguard in the more recent years. But Jason takes us back to the period before Jack Bogle became the builder of the Vanguard empire, which, by the way, as we've talked before, and many have, had a very, very slow beginning. If nothing else, we know that Jack Bogle was a tenacious man. But Jason first met him in 1993. He was a mutual funds editor. I don't think he was at the Wall Street Journal at that point. He may have been at Money Magazine. But anyway, he had a chance to interview him, Jack Bogle, when he was the chairman and chief executive. He was of Vanguard. And that was in his early 60s that Bogle, he said, looked like he spent decades in hand-to-hand combat with the angel of death, as indeed he had. Multiple near-fatal heart attacks had gnarled his hands, creased his craggy face with wrinkles, and yellowed his eyes. Jason says, and unlike anybody else in the financial industry, Mr. Bogle said exactly what he was thinking on the record. The way most investment firms treated their clients was shameful. Most mutual funds' annual expenses were larcenous. The attempt to beat the market was a fool's game. Brokers' commissions were like highway robbery. But Jason goes on to talk about the time before Jack Bogle became so devoted to the individual investor. He says Mr. Bogle hadn't always been his own industry's harshest critic. Like St. Paul, the former persecutor of the first Christians, Mr. Bogle blazed with the zeal of the convert. He knew about high fees and performance chasing firsthand. He had long defended many of the industry practices he eventually derided. And Jason goes on to say that in an article written for the Financial Analyst Journal in 1960, Mr. Bogle trashed the idea of an index fund that would buy and hold all the stocks in a market benchmark. Bogle said the concept was so flawed, it would underperform by about 0.75 percentage points annually. And Mr. Bogle approvingly quoted a critic saying, quote, "The relative inflexibility of these funds makes them undesirable for the average investor." And here's one more unbelievable comment here. In a 1973 speech to the Investment Company Institute, a trade group for asset managers, Mr. Bogle said, "Studies critiquing fund performance were wholly invalid and declared, I do not see how the mutual fund industry's long-term record of performance could be very much better." He noted that they had demonstrated excellence to their investors. In other words, Jack Bogle was a great advocate for active management. And the reason I find this so fascinating is because many of us, myself included, go out into the world and we're almost like preachers about how great index funds and the concept of indexing is. And of course, we hold up Jack Bogle as the man who started the whole process. And isn't it fascinating that it took him some time before he came around to finding that this was the right way? So maybe one of the lessons we should get from Jack Bogle's life and the whole index fund story might be that we should be a little more patient in waiting for people to come around and understand that this is probably the best way for almost all investors. And as I read Jason Zweig's comments, it made me ask the question, a what if question. How the world could change so easily. What if, and by the way, before I ask the question, let me tell you what happened to him. In 1974, this is from Jason's writing, Mr. Bogle was fired as chief executive officer of Wellington Management Company, a large asset manager based at the time in Philadelphia and Boston. Bogle said he was heartbroken, my career in shambles, and he immediately realized he needed to find a radical new way of doing business. And so he adapted an idea proposed in 1967 by the economist Paul Samuelson. Now, the what if. What would have been the future of indexing, at least in the world of Jack Bogle, if he had not been fired? And what if, after starting the fund in 1976, it had not compounded for, actually from 1975 to 1999, it was a 17% plus compound rate of return. What if it hadn't achieved that return? And remember, that was the market's return. That wasn't Jack's return. It was simply the market. And what if he had started that mutual fund in 2000 after the 25-year run of 17%, because people do love to buy performance? And since that fund would have started in 2000, the compound rate of return, as we know now, for 20 years would have been less than 6%. And what if, when he was forced to resign, because at Vanguard, you have to resign at age 70, so he actually had already stepped down, I think for health reasons, when he was younger, as the president of the company, but when he was 70, he was forced to step down. And what if, when he did step down and retire, in quotes, his wife had said, "Sweetheart, you know, you've worked very hard. I think that it would be great if we could just enjoy our retirement and do some traveling." And what if he had said yes? What a difference that would have made. And what if he hadn't decided to make that decision to start his own company? And by the way, it was a radical idea. I mean, he could have started an index fund without it having been built to, in essence, being owned and working and making money for the shareholders who are invested in that family of funds. And what if they hadn't decided, after they had been in business for about a year — this is going back, they started in 76, but in 1977, they decided to eliminate the commissions on the funds. See, back then, almost all, not all, but almost all mutual fund sales were burdened by a commission, and not a small commission. Commissions then, they would say, were 8.5% of the money you put in. Well, yes, they were 8.5%, but if you compare that 8.5% to the money that you actually have invested, it's a commission of 9.3%. Commissions were very high. And so that move to eliminate the commission and make it a no-load fund, what if they hadn't done that? And of course, we know the rest of the story. The funds cut costs. And by the way, I met with Jack Bogle for 90 minutes in June of 2017. And he was so proud of his commitment to frugality. I mean, he talked about flying coach, and he talked about taking advantage of discounts in hotels, and all of those things that were a sign of his focus on keeping costs low. And the costs weren't always dirt cheap. By 1978, according to Jason Zweig, annual expenses on the funds at Vanguard had fallen below the industry average. So they weren't dirt cheap. They were still they were below the industry average, but the industry average was sky high. In fact, I'll talk about the profitability of the the industry at that time. But a decade later, I guess 1988 or so, the Vanguard funds were half as expensive as the average fund. And now they are about 90% cheaper than the average fund. And of course, we know what Vanguard did to the expenses in the mutual fund industry. They forced them lower. Not as low as Vanguard, but certainly lower than what they were. And let me just share what Zweig said about in those early days of Vanguard. He says, "In those days, mutual fund management companies minted money, regularly raking in at least 25 cents of after-tax profit on every dollar of fee revenue. 25% after-tax profit. That is, and by the way, taxes back then were very high when profits were high. And some funds were charging upwards of 2% a year. So it wasn't difficult for Bogle and Vanguard to bring fees down. But certainly I'm sure that Jack never thought that they would get down to the point where some funds are charging 1/100 of 1%, while some at Fidelity have zero expenses. As Jason says, with investors yanking money out of funds with expenses much higher than Vanguard's, other fund companies had little choice but to cut their fees. Between 2002 and 2018, annual expenses at the average active stock picking fund fell to 3/4 of 1% from 1.07. So think about at the end of 2018, actively managed funds averaged 3/4 of 1%, while Vanguard is averaging 1/10 of 1%. In the last paragraph of this article, Jason Zweig was to have a video interview with Bogle in December of 2018, and due to Bogle's health, the doctors forced him to back out. But on the phone, Jason had talked about questions he was going to ask, and one was, what had driven him against all odds? And Bogle's response was, never feeling one damn moment of doubt. I am who I am, the hell with it. Now, he was supposedly a pretty crusty and a forceful guy. I must admit, and I'm going to talk in a few minutes about my meeting with him, that he was actually, he was a gentle giant, I felt. He was very, very kind. He was open, sharing, and as Zweig said, he's a fellow who tells it like it is. So I would like to share my view of how I think he has impacted us, virtually all of us, and talk about what about what he did should remain in our conscious mind when we're thinking about investing. And of course, I knew I had to find 10 things that the impact of Bogle's work was making our life better. Well, the first one, the most obvious one, is the low expenses. Because if we look at what people were used to paying to have their money managed within a mutual fund, and we look at what between Bogle's work and the fact that other funds had to compete with Vanguard, billions and billions of dollars have been saved for the financial futures of your families rather than the financial futures of the people who run the mutual fund companies. And I have, with young people, focused on the impact of making an extra 0.5% a year. And by the way, it's so easy to find ways to make an extra 1% a year. It even gets juicier because with $5,000 a year investment over 40 years and able to make an additional 1% from 9% to 10% because you did reduce fees, expenses of running those funds, that actually totals about an additional $3 million over your lifetime on that $200,000 investment when you take into consideration all the distributions and retirement and the money you leave to others. That extra 1%, whether it's from 5 to 6 or 7 to 8 or 9 to 10, that is golden. So that's the one we all think about, and that's the one that people often focus about. They just want to find the cheapest mutual fund. The second thing that happened was that Bogle created a fund that had more diversification. Now, we know what that means. We can't necessarily put, they didn't think in terms of that creating additional returns because of diversification. They thought in terms of that actually reducing risk, because the risk of one or 10 or 20 companies is many times that of 500 companies. But there's another point, I'll call it the third point, about what it is that Bogle did by chance, let's say, because decades later, the academics were able to determine that portfolios that own more stocks, more companies in an asset class, are likely to have a higher rate of return than those that have fewer. And that is exactly the opposite of what we believed, at least when I went into the industry in the mid-60s. The idea was that the way you get better returns is by owning the really good companies. Well, of course, we know which companies are really good after they have done it. But before they've done it, people seem to have a problem being able to find those premium companies. Number four, index funds lower the turnover. Now, lowering the turnover, the cost of buying and selling, I mean, it's not just the commissions of buying and selling, but it is also the spread between the bid and ask. Because you buy at the ask price and you sell at the bid price. And during many of those years the commissions were very, very high and spreads were very wide, the index fund was saving people a ton. So that's number four. Now, it turns out there's another advantage to that low turnover, and that low turnover reduces taxes. Now, I understand that when you have money in a 401k or an IRA, those taxes are not a consideration, but if it's in a taxable account, and a lot of money in the S&P 500 is in a taxable account, that tax becomes a heavy burden. I looked up at Morningstar just to see. The longest period I could see was 15 years. In the same category with all the other funds that are like the S&P 500, the Vanguard S&P 500 Index Trust is in the top 11% after taxes, which basically means that they are producing a better after-tax return than almost all mutual funds. And the other thing, this is number six, we all have, when we started investing, have fears that we don't know enough. And if we don't know enough, how are we ever going to accomplish the kind of return that would make us a really good investor? In fact, you actually start thinking that in order to be a really good investor, you got to get some information that other people don't have. Well, it turns out, and I am sure that Bogle did not anticipate this, but Standard & Poor's, and we've talked before on the podcast about the semi-annual SPIVA report, and that the Standard & Poor's tracks all the mutual funds. They track the survivors as well as those that fail, and they compare them, they break them down into quartiles in terms of return. But here's the bottom line. Only 7.5% Of all the equity mutual funds in the same category, along with the S&P 500, were able over 15 years to make more money than the index itself. Which means that you get to be in the top 10% without having to be a genius, without having to stay up late reading balance sheets and talking to people about industries and competition and management and all those things that few of us are qualified to talk about. But it gets better because of all of the mutual funds that were in existence 15 years ago, at least according to the Standard & Poor's organization, only 35% of them are still in business. The others have been merged away, and that is typically because their results were not up to par. So, is that the end of the advantage in terms of performance? No. It could even become much greater than that. Because here's what they don't report. They don't report the returns for all of the funds that you might have owned within that same asset class, like the S&P 500. But you can get that when you look at the SPIVA report on how did the quartiles do, so that they break the returns basically on average for the top 25%, then the next 25% down, and then down another 25, and finally the bottom 25%. It's important to know that the bottom quartile, and if you buy an actively managed fund, you could end up in the bottom quartile. We know that's a possibility because a quarter of the funds end up there. But at the end of that 15-year period, while the top quartile averaged 9.2, by the way, the index did better than that, but the quartile was 9.2 and above. The fourth quartile was 7.7 and below. So by owning an index, you are likely to be in the top 10%, but if you only ended up in the top 25%, the return would likely be as much as 1.5% to maybe even 2% better. Now we're talking about a life-changing difference in return. Now I've got four more, and these are not specific to a number that I can say is life-changing. But anecdotally, I can tell you from having been around this industry since the mid-60s, these funds, I think, are life-changing and produce much higher returns than people understand. Because number seven, when you trust a strategy, you are more likely to stay the course. And almost every professional I know will tell you the reason that most people don't do well with their investments is because they don't stay the course. They give up. They lose trust. You don't have to worry with an index fund whether management is doing their job. Well, you know, their job is to replicate the index. Maybe they aren't doing it perfectly. I don't know if without really looking carefully whether one would know, but we assume that they will do that because it isn't all that much to ask. But I think that trust, that could even double the return of a lifetime. Just the fact that you trusted what you were doing was going to work, but you're not sure about that actively managed fund. And I suspect if we looked at the people who stayed the course, continued to buy and hold through 2000, 2002, and 2007 through 2009, kept investing if they were working in their 401k, because a lot of people stopped, I will bet that most of those people who stayed the course were committed to something they understood and trust, and that is most likely to be the index fund. And the eighth reason. I believe that if we are committed and we believe in trust index funds, it is going to eliminate opportunities for commission salespeople to come in and sell you some product that is probably not in your best interest. And even worse than just a bad investment, a poor investment that maybe had great performance recently, when you're committed to putting your money away into an index, low cost, no load, broadly diversified, you are less likely to find a Ponzi scheme that would entice you to not just make a bad investment, but a disastrous investment. And number nine, there's something here about index funds that make them very special. It goes back to building that trust. And that is that the most famous people in the industry have come out and put their stamp of approval on index funds. Now, I know there's some grumbling around that index funds are going to be a problem if everybody indexes. But I suspect that most of that talk is coming from the people who are competing with the index funds. Because if I'm putting money away for the next 5, 10, 15, 20 years, I don't particularly care what happens day to day. I'm putting money there for the long term. And if you need your money in the next year to 5 years, maybe you shouldn't be in any kind of an equity position. But when you realize that Warren Buffett and virtually every academic that I know will tell you that if you want to put money intelligently and prudently away for the long term, that index funds are the best place to put them. And again, it's another trust item. And then number 10, once you get it, how powerful an index fund is, how you can take the high risk of owning a company, any major company, let's not forget Enron, the seventh largest company, and the people in the 401k plan working at Enron were in many cases putting virtually all of their money into Enron stock. In the Northwest, we had Washington Mutual. Similar story. But here's the thing that happens. Once you understand how an index works and that owning 500 companies becomes a whale of a lot less risky than owning 1 or 5 or 10 companies, you gain some peace of mind. But all of a sudden, when somebody comes along, and here's when I had my conversation with Jack Bogle that it got interesting, was to really squeeze out of him how he felt about small cap and how he felt about value and how he felt about Eugene Fama and Ken French and the work they've done. And from the conversation, my sense is that probably John Bogle wouldn't consider buying small companies for his portfolio one at a time. He may not even be willing to invest heavily in value, but I do believe, and I'll get back to his beliefs about what investors should do in just a second, because it had a huge impact on me. But the one thing about an index fund, that once you look at an asset class that may carry more risk, but you own 2 or 3 or 4 or 5,000 companies in that asset class, it makes it possible for people who would not otherwise maybe trust small cap or trust value or trust international or trust emerging markets. The index makes it more likely to trust those very productive, at least in the long term, asset classes. And I guess in terms of what these index funds have done for you, low cost, broad diversification, knowing that you were you had minimal risk in your portfolio, except for, of course, the risk going down. And index funds are perfect to put together with bonds to create that balanced portfolio to address that limit of risk that you might have. So they have been a life changer for a lot of people. And a lot of you have written to me over the years and have said that you have found peace of mind in the strategies that we've been recommending. And by the way, others recommend very similar kinds of strategies. And I know that a lot of people feel comfortable with, they put all the money in U.S. strategy that Jack Bogle advocated for so many years. And you didn't need small cap and you didn't need value. Just take the S&P 500. Later it became the total market index that he favored. But the fact is that the total market index and the S&P 500 have almost exactly the same long-term return because the small and other value in the mid-cap is so small in the whole scheme of things that it doesn't change the needle hardly at all. But I think if we were able to talk, that many of you would find out it is not because of the portfolio that I recommended. It was because it was a portfolio built with index funds and you trusted first and foremost those index funds. And as far as how John Bogle changed my life, I just feel so fortunate that I took the time to fly back to Philadelphia in June of 2017 and spend 90 minutes with him. We had had Jack on our radio show many times. He was on about once a year over a period of 10 years. And he was always very patient with us, and we always ribbed him about not having any small cap and any value. And by the way, in the latter years that we had him on, he became more forgiving and was understanding why we were doing what we were doing. I had a dream that someday I'd be able to sit and chat with him. And I had a lot of things I wanted to understand, why he believed what he did. And what I realized and how he changed me a lot is that he was not trying to make people rich. He was a person. In fact, he had a book. It was called Enough, and it was not about building great wealth. It wasn't about legacy. And I don't mean that he didn't want people to have a legacy, but his concern was for the people who couldn't afford to pay the high expenses of mutual funds, who couldn't afford to pay the taxes and all that goes along with actively managed funds, that they needed that money in order to have enough money to live out their life with financial respect. So when I talked to him about why the target date funds had bonds in them when you're 21 years old, and why the target date funds didn't have enough small cap to have any impact to move the needle in terms of return, and why there wouldn't be more value after in the portfolio after all of the academic research that had been done. And I understood, finally, it was about keeping things simple. That the minute that we do things that confuse people, that make people question whether what they're doing is right. For example, if you had a target date fund that was half small and half large, half U.S. and half international, you're going to have years that your tracking error against the S&P 500 is going to be huge. There can be a 15 or 20% difference in return in a year because you put all these different asset classes together. And Jack Bogle doesn't want the investors to have to struggle with those kinds of decisions. He knows that there is there is likely to be a better long-term return by having the small and the value than by not having it. He also knows that of the S&P 500, because there are long periods of time where if you took it back to 250 or back to 100 S&P 500 stocks instead of 500, the returns would be lower, not higher. And so he understands all of this, but he also understands that the key to long-term success of investors is to have a sense of trust and comfort. And that is why Chris Pederson, Daryl Balls, Rich Buck, and myself have been working, and this is because of Jack Bogle, on simplifying the process and in order to come as close as we can to what people will get if they do the very complicated 10 or 12 fund solution. Because if we can help people get most of that return, and I don't think they're going to get all of it, but most of that return with two funds, and that's all they have to deal with for the rest of their life. And there's a simple formula that shows you exactly how much you have in those two funds, depending upon how old you are, how many years from retirement you are. He taught me that, and it is probably the right message. And I have found in just the last months, as I've sat down with greenhorn, young investors who are afraid of the market, who don't understand the market. And when I explain two funds, a target date fund and a small cap value, or a target date fund and a large cap value, just two funds. And all they have to do is once a year make a rebalance based on a formula, their age times 1.5. It's easy. And I want to thank Jack Bogle for having motivated that push to figuring out how to make investing not only efficient, low cost, broadly diversified, but to do our best to do what the rest of the people went on to teach after Jack Bogle got that index fund working. And that what they were teaching was how to take advantage of those asset classes that have historically been productive. We are going to miss Jack Bogle. Years ago, when people asked, how long are you going to keep working? I said, well, my goal is to work as long as Jack Bogle works. He made it to 89. It looks like I've got, maybe another 14 years of work ahead of me. But I can tell you that it is it's the most, some of the most joyous work of my life. And it is a pleasure and it is an honor to do what I can do to help you apply the work of Jack Bogle, the work of Gene Fama and Ken French and others in the hopes of a better financial future. That's what Jack wanted for you. That's what I want for you. Thanks for listening.
That was Paul Merriman with Sound Investing. Sound Investing, soundinvesting.com, and paulmerriman.com are produced and exclusively owned by Paul Merriman, who is solely responsible for their content. For more information, free articles, mutual fund recommendations, and more, visit paulmerriman.com.